happy to note that prior to our appearance before the House Committee, Dr. Bosky had already been cited for contempt in the House, in the Congress, by a vote of 339-4. Among the four were Congressman Mark Antonio and Adam Clayton Powell of New York.
Was there much support for you among groups? Did people come to your defense?
At first, we had enormous support everywhere. There were meetings being held all through beginning in 46 until the trial, which was in 48. The Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee all over the country was able to hold enormous meetings with widespread support, and there was no fear at all expressed by the people who supported the organization.
So they held rallies and
they
support.
They held rallies. They had they raised funds. It was an exhilarating period for the organization. Yeah. Most of these meetings resulted in resolutions and wires and telegrams to Congress, and a big public pressure campaign was underway.
These are the support meetings.
Yes. In July 1947, after we had been after Congress had voted contempt citations for all the members of the executive board, a trial was held in Washington in the federal court, and we were found guilty. Sentence was given on July 16th.
Guilty of what?
Guilty of contempt of Congress.
Mm-hmm.
Among the 16 were 11 before, but there were 16.
Mm-hmm.
In any event, only 11 actually went to jail, and I think that was because others bowed out, either by saying that they would give the books and records, or by saying that they, or for some other reason, were able to get leniency. Anyway, I know that in two cases in particular, I have mentioned that two were not subpoenaed.
Mm-hmm.
Two others said they would get the books and records. And so that left four out of 16, 12.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure about the 12th one.
Mm-hmm.
I know that there are only 11 that actually went to jail. Now, of course, the 16 may have included Dr. Bosky and Helen Brown.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't thought of that. Anyway, the best of my recollection, there were three women involved on the executive board, and Helen Bryan, who was the executive secretary. And there were two trade unionists, James Lustig of the UE and myself. During all this period between 46 and 47, I reported regularly to the executive board of Local 6, informing them of what was taking place. And in each instance, the vote was taken with the support group.
Mm-hmm.
And there was strong support among the union members for my position.
Mm-hmm. How was it manifested?
What?
How did they show their support?
By voting, mm-hmm, in various shop meetings and also in the executive board itself to support me against the House American, mm-hmm, Activities Committee. And there was a great deal of excellent educational work that was carried on, showing the nature of the House Committee and the danger of fascism in America. And it must be remembered also that the hotel union was made up of very large numbers of minorities, ethnic minorities.
Mm-hmm.
so there was quite a good deal of sympathy for the Spanish that we used. In addition to the situation in the country. So, quite a bit of money was raised among the hotel workers themselves and among other hotel unions, other food workers unions who are sympathetic, particularly the Cooks Union, Local 89, and the Cafeteria Union. The support of the union continued. Life straight grew. After my conviction and up until the time due to the fact that the Supreme Court refused certiorari, which meant that we would have to go to jail for contempt. The union members were very supportive.
And then what happened when you had to go to jail?
Well, that's a little ahead. There are one or two other points I want to make in regard to this period. It is interesting to note that the CIO Executive Council in 1947 prohibited the state councils from making gifts or sending delegates to organizations other than a selected list of 36 groups approved by their national headquarters.
That was after that, partly?
No. And we started a campaign through the National CIO to reverse this decision. I'm afraid we did not succeed in getting to change the mind. Nevertheless, as the campaign wore on, more and more people were coming to our defense. Considering the House on American Activities plan to destroy the domain defenses that we think may be reprehensible. Among them were some rather important people, like Mr. Olin Downs, the music critic of the New York Times.
The constituency? The constituency on this case here?
Spanish refugee appeal. That was one of the options of the organization. That was one of the refugee committees. A trial of all members of the board. On May 20th, on or about May 25th, 1947, the contempt charges were brought before a district court, federal district court, and all of us were placed on trial. Our lawyers were with us, and the trial lasted about 2 weeks, during which time jury selection was involved and so forth. We were quite sure that we would not win because of the method of jury selection. There were so many people who were in the employ or close to the employ of the government in the District of Columbia that it seemed almost impossible to get an impartial judgment of our situation.
Unlike today when the jury is so good.
Yeah. We were found guilty with the exception of Dr. Barsky and Helen Bryan, who were given 6 months, we were given a 3-month sentence and a $500 fine. The fine was matched by the Joint Antitious Refugee.
Now, what was your union's attitude now?
Following conviction, they still were very supportive. They there were homes to help and give money and telegrams and wires and pressure, put pressure on congressmen to prevent our going to jail.
And you still kept your job?
And I still kept my job, and they said they would support me to the end. However, when we finally were unable, when after the Supreme Court decision against us, we finally had to go to jail, union was at this time in serious trouble with the AFL leadership. And the leadership was determined to get rid of all those people in the union whom they felt were could be perhaps vulnerable to attack as communists. It was not true that all of them were communists, but nevertheless, there were some, I think, 18 organizers, staff people, the editor of the journal and the educational director, who was myself, and various others who were under attack by the international. And upon my conviction, I was informed that it would probably not be possible for me to return. However, a group within the union said they would continue the fight for me, and they did until they themselves were ousted. And that virtually amounted to my being ousted from my
Mm-hmm. Now, this was taken to the Supreme Court.
It went all the way up to the Supreme Court, yes. And that's why there was a gap between the time of the conviction, which was in 1947, and the actual jail term, which was in 1950. Mm-hmm. And on June 1st, 1950, three women were sent to Alderson, West Virginia, and the rest were dispersed in various jails which were not maximum security, because this was not considered a felony, it was considered a misdemeanor. Contempt of Congress was a misdemeanor.
So you went to jail in order to.
So I went to jail in Alderson on the 1st of June, 1950, and served a 3-month sentence, being released on September 1st, 1950.
And while you were in jail, what did you plan for yourself to do? Did you want to use that period to convert the other inmates to radicalism, or?
No, I first appraised the situation, and because of my general experience among the people, I saw that the fellow prisoners were not the type of people who would be amenable to any kind of discussion of the problems that confront us, except in a very personal way. There were mostly, there were a great many teenagers, young women, who were not being rehabilitated at all, who had, for one reason or another, gotten into difficulty. Some had crossed state lines and stolen cars. Others were in for forgery. Some of them were people who had minor charges against them, but because they came from areas where there was no place to keep to put young women, they were sent to Alderson.
Yeah, were they mainly black?
The Alderson situation was a little different from most jails. It was originally founded by Jane Addams. It was an attempt at penal reform, and the vision of the social workers who were able to get a resolution through Congress to establish the institution was that it would be a place where young women would have the opportunity for rehabilitation. So the Alderson area was chosen because it is almost completely a security area, surrounded by mountains. Escape was practically impossible. But it was very beautiful there in the country, and they set up what they called a campus, in which they had individual cottages. There were about 8 or 10 individual cottages. And each cottage was headed, supposedly, in accordance with their plan, by a social worker, not a police. And
there's still two when you were there.
Yes, and there were two, and each person would have an individual room. And that life would be almost on a cottage basis. Everyone would, the women inmates would participate in the cooking and serving and taking care of the cottage and having their own rooms to take care of as well. That this was the ideal which was projected. The cottages were segregated. There were whites in about 10 cottages, and about 2 of them had blacks. And the black cottages, the cottages with black inmates, were manned by whites. When I arrived, the situation had deteriorated. The original plan for the campus set up was changed because the Department of Justice had now stepped in, and there was a new warden who was definitely a police woman, appointed not by the social workers as previous wardens had been appointed, but by the Department of Justice itself. And the whole setup was now coming under the jurisdiction of the Department of Justice as a legitimate prison, no longer a reform institution, a penal reform institution. So this was the beginning of a transition. The new warden was very austere. There were still some leftovers from the social workers. There were a few social workers who were counselors, but most of the people in charge of the cottages were police women. That is to say, they were matrons, but they were appointed by the Department of Justice, and they were definitely under the jurisdiction of the police.
Tokyo Rose was there.
She came after I was.
Oh.
In general, the feeling among the inmates was that there was too much restriction. You see, the rooms were closed at 9 o'clock every night and not open until 8 o'clock in the morning. There were a number of pregnant girls in the cottage, and in one instance, the pregnant girl went into labor and screamed and couldn't get out of the room. And couldn't get help until they opened the doors. But in that case, the women made so much noise on the floor that they had to go to her. They had to send someone up to her to help her.
Was she pregnant before she was there?
Yes, she was pregnant during when she came in. She was pregnant already. My own attitude, although this was not true of my fellow. My own attitude, although this was not true of my fellow Jada
Boyd. You had a difference of opinion.
We didn't have a difference of opinion as far as I'd like to change that. There was no openly stated difference of opinion, but our attitude and our behavior was somewhat different. They were on very friendly terms with the inmates, and tried very hard to be help to them in one way or another. One of the executive board members left her clothing to them, and so on. But in the end, they were not rewarded because the prisoners were not influenced.
You didn't have the philosophy that all these prisoners were really political prisoners?
No, I didn't.
Because they were poor and weren't brought up with advantages?
I thought they were victims of society, but I didn't think they knew anything about politics, and I didn't regard them as political prisoners because they didn't have any knowledge. I was in the jail when the Korean War was declared, and the patriotism and the flag waving among these girls was incredible. I mean, they were very illiterate, many were illiterate, couldn't read or write. They had to have you write letters home for them. Many of them were completely ignorant of what was going on in the world. They were frustrated, poor, young people who had a very bad deal with society. And I thought of them as society victims, but I saw that in the short space of 3 months, I couldn't convert them. So my attitude was very one of great care in caution in relation to them. I didn't want to try to develop any personal relations, and I didn't want to talk about my personal life with them, which is all that they knew. They only knew about their own personal life.
Were you afraid they were coming to use your personal life?
Well, no, I thought that they may be infiltrated school pigeons. And actually, I was right in one instance, because they did try to provoke me. And there was one instance during the jail term when they tried to provoke me. And I was brought before the warden in the prison, who said that she could see to it that I was I would not have as good a situation as I have now if I continued. I had a feeling that they were fearful of me because I was an educational director, and I came from a trade union, and they were fearful of propaganda. There were one or two quite intelligent girls who had been hookers, prostitutes who had been arrested because of busting state lines on white slavery charges. And these girls were trustees. There were two of them. One had her room across from mine, and became very friendly with me, and said that she too had no use for the FBI, and she had no use for the government, and she built up quite a strong case for herself as being anti-government, and one got the impression that she was somewhat political.
Mm-hmm.
She said she knew the officials of the hotel union in Detroit, and that they were not very good people. This was true, mm-hmm. but they were mostly racketeers in that area. However, I rather liked her and was taken in by her, but when the Korean War broke out, she had a newspaper which showed had a headline about the communists. And she called me and said, "Now what do you think?" She said, "Are we going to destroy the communists?" And of course her whole stance was one of waving the flag. And I kept silent, and I said, "I prefer peace to war." In which case she became very violent and shouted in the hall and called attention to herself. And the warden, who lived not too far from us, had a room not too far from us, came out of her, it was almost as if it had been a prearranged affair, came out and said, "What are you doing, Shower? Why are you stirring up this controversy? Why are you provoking this anger?" And I said, "I'm sorry, I just looked at the headlines that the other prisoner had shown me, and that was all. I had very little conversation with her." She said, "Well, go to your room. We'll talk about that." The next day I was called to the warden's office, and was told that I had started some sort of a rumpus in the hall, and it was not permissible. And so I simply said, "The rumpus must be in the mind of the prisoner who created it, because I didn't have anything to do with it." That gave me an alert, and I recognized then that there were all sorts of people around that could not be trusted. And so I was very cautious in my relations, and I never had any further trouble. Although, as a result of this particular situation, they put me in the building of the chief warden so that I could be watched over by her.
Mm-hmm.
And since I was supposed to be an educator, and they decided that they would give me something that they thought was of an intellectual nature, namely to write a manual for the clerical workers as to what is expected of them. It took me about 10 days, and I wrote a manual. I didn't have any idea what they wanted, and I didn't really care.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote something, and I gave it to the warden. She was directly over me. She supervised my work. You see,
mm-hmm.
Previously, this was not the case. I didn't have anyone looking after me. So when I finished with the manual, for which she thanked me, she then told me that they were going to destroy all the records of the previous wardens because the Department of Justice was going in to take over for free charge. And all she wanted was for me to go through their records and note the names and addresses of previous wardens and previous staff officers and people who had applied for jobs there so they could have a file.
Mm-hmm.
So she sent me up to what was considered their attic. And there I uncovered some extraordinary material, which gave me an idea of what had happened in the past. I tried to write about it, but they wouldn't permit anything to go out of me.
Afterwards it would have been mentioned.
But I did not have any notes. They don't permit you to leave with any notes in your possession. And I didn't have the notes. I could only talk about it, but I couldn't remember to write about it. It was an extraordinary experience. How long was I there?
Yeah, the job of looking at the files.
Well, about 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
See, I was there altogether
3 months.
Yes.
So 6 weeks you spent looking at these files.
Every day, all day. That was my job, my work. Every prisoner is getting a job. And this was my work. And I spent a great deal of time reading the records. And I found some extraordinary things, particularly their attitude towards blacks. The fact that when a black woman would apply for a job as a warden, even though she had credentials, such as, for example, one person who was a graduate of Teachers College, who wanted to come here as the warden. She was interviewed, and she was found entirely satisfactory, and they assigned her to the house where the blacks lived. And they put her in charge of a laundry. And she was, and they would not let her live on campus because there was no possibility for her to live on campus at all. So she had to find a room outside of campus. And it was a white Southern cracker community, very, very rabidly prejudiced. And she was unable to find even a place to live. She finally had to give up, and she wrote a very strong letter of protest when she left.
It was in the file.
It was in the file, yes. It was fascinating. There were fascinating materials on their meetings, the minutes of their meetings, and the way in which they conducted their work. And the warden previous to the warden which was in charge of the prison when I was there, was a Sanskrit professor and knew nothing about penal reform. But she was chosen by the social workers because she was such a fine personality, you see, and she was a do-gooder. She wanted to undertake reform, but didn't know anything about it. And this is the type of thing that led to the demise of the whole penal reform idea. Of course, there was also the financial business, the fact that the government was supporting something that it had no control over, that the controls were in the hands of private people. There were other reasons for taking over, you see. They felt that the prison population was such that they had to have stronger police control, and that the social workers were too tolerant. It was a deliberate decision to take all of this out of the hands of the reformers.
What was the prisoner's reaction to you?
What?
What was the prisoner's reaction to you?
I developed no strong attachment to anybody, but I was very polite to everybody, and they have to admit that I was courteous, and I didn't step on their toes, and I didn't try to find out anything personal about them. It was friendly, but not overtly hostile. But here and there one felt the hostility because the three of us were intellectuals compared to all of them, you see. And they thought of us as middle class and as well to do and just having trouble with the government, but really not a gang, you see.
And what about the other? Did you get a chance to see the others that you were in jail with?
Well, they were in the same building with me. Mm-hmm. I was on the ground floor, and they were on the second floor. So they had their group of prisoners that they were with all the time, and I had my group. You see, after the work was over, we had had our dinner. We were allowed leisure in a living room, and there were two living rooms.
You really had little contact with them.
I didn't have much contact with them. We would meet sometimes when we would go to a movie. They would very often have a movie, or they would have knitting classes or something like that. And if they chose to go to knitting classes, I would be there. And we would exchange words with each other. But there was not a very long relationship between us, because it was impossible to have that kind of communication.
Mm-hmm. What about, did you read a lot while you were there?
I read a great deal. They had a good library. And incidentally, I found books by my husband in their library. So there was a time, you see, when they were accepting there were a great many Howard Bass books, and there were a number of books by Malk and so on. And it was interesting because apparently the librarians had a very had a sort of liberal approach to the books.
And Bernard visited you?
Yes.
What?
He visited me. He was allowed to visit that once a month.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the lawyers came. They were allowed to visit whenever it was necessary, so they came about twice a month. And of course, we were informed about the campaigns that were going on. They were trying to get conversation sentence, and then they were trying to get parties, and trying all sorts of things, but nothing worked, really, because the intent of the government was to destroy the organization. Now, after we went to prison, there was a great fear that spread among the supporters of the Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee. And it was obvious already when we came out that most of the support had declined, that the organization was now really...
Is that the new atmosphere in the country?
Yes, it was the atmosphere in the country, and the fact that we actually went to jail. This is something mm-hmm. that the supporters of the committee could not believe was possible. And when they found that it was possible, and that all these doctors and writers and journalists were going to jail, and then the